Welcome to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
Well, should professional cheerleaders be paid? Did you know more and more professional cheerleaders are making the case because they don't get paid much, barely $75 in most cases, and sometimes up to $100 per game. We're going to talk about it on the program. Plus, we're going to talk about and have a segment as to how you actually speak to your children about hate and bigotry. Very important segment straight ahead on the program. And probably been a while since you've heard the statement far out, depending upon your age, of course. But during the 60s and the 70s, space exploration was all the rage in America. And I wonder if it's coming back. Hello there, Terry here on Think America, where we reason first and then converse. I'm Terry Gilbert. I'm your host, and this is America's Town Hall. So welcome to it. I present thought-provoking conversation starters to real people, real Americans, in a town hall session, and they let their hair down with me, and we chew on some very interesting topics, all Americana. So I want to say hello to Ray, who drew the long straw to be in today. Hi, Ray. He is a real estate investor.
No, actually, that's our other guest. I'm the HR professional.
You're the HR professional. Okay.
So I can play a real estate investor on the weekends if you like.
Oh, you do that too to make even more money. An HR professional. So you see a lot of employee issues all day long. John is the real estate investor?
The really retired investor.
Okay,
yes, absolutely.
Good. Well, you're both richer than I am.
I was going to say.
Happy to have you on the program.
Every diversified portfolio has some real estate in it. So.
All righty, except for mine. I just have radio in it.
That is a sales opportunity.
I want to give a shout out to our friends in Port Orchard, Washington, KGTK AM 920 and KITZ AM 1440. Let's get going. Bringing to the microphone the issue of a retired general. Speaking of retire, I'll start with you, John, first. John Kelly, same names. He is now President Trump's, I guess, sigh of relief coming into the White House. He's charged with replacing the chaotic atmosphere of the White House. Whether you're left or you're right, most people say, what's going on there? It's tumultuous, right? Probably because it's hard to be an anchor or a rock for Donald Trump. He's, of course, his own man. So here comes Kelly, and he's already told the White House staffers that he's in charge, and everybody answers to him. Nobody even gets to the Oval Office, and that includes Ivanka and everybody else, family included, unless you go through him. Is he the man for the job? John.
Apparently he is. I think he's got enough of a realistic outlook to know that he's not going to change a 70-year-old successful businessman, right? He's not going to change him, especially one who believes in himself so much and believes in what he's done. In other words, beating 17 senators and governors and overcoming, you know, all that
kind of stuff. On the campaign trail.
Yeah, and he did it himself. You know, he trademarked Make America Great Again in 2013. So this has been in his head, and he finally got to express himself. So I think Kelly understands that, but I think he's made the sale, made the deal with Trump that have at it, boss. Go say what you want, tweet all you want, but inside these four walls, we're just going to control the flow. You do everything. You make the decisions. Nobody's going to tell you what
to
think.
But inside the West Wing, everybody goes through me.
Right. That way, boss, you can tweet. You can tweet even
more. And you know
what?
Interesting, Ray. We haven't heard since this happened, we haven't heard about a lot of tumult in the West Wing as a result of it.
And I think the real true indicators of General Kelly's success are not going to be necessarily what he is going to be able to get to on the media or whether or not President Trump, as you were saying, is going to either stop or mediate his tweeting. What's going to be really his mark of success is if the leaks stop. That's first and foremost one of the things he needs to have, which I think was the exit of some of the most recent people, but also the legislative priority. The legislative priorities of the president was which one of the things that Reince Priebus could not do. That was one of the reasons why they brought him in the first place, because the grand idea was that we're going to make this pitch to the establishment with a guy that Paul Ryan is comfortable with. They're from the same state. We can probably get the president's agenda through in this legislative session, and that obviously did not happen at all. There was no ability for Reince Priebus to move any kind of legislative football for the president. So that's going to be the real telltale sign of how effective he can be as a chief of staff to drive that. Because traditionally, that there is a role for that chief of staff to have in the legislative process, to be able to be that conduit where the president's platform ends up playing out in the House and Senate. So if he can drive that, that would be a real true mark of success.
Well, he tried in the first 6 months or so.
Priebus?
President Trump.
Yeah, but
tried
that is...
through, and then Bannon's gone. We all know that.
Yeah.
Tried through these sort of politicos or thinkers.
Correct.
Those with political philosophy like his. And it failed. And it's embarrassing.
It failed because of a lot of different factors. There were people who wanted it to fail that were on the other side of the table, who were not basically negotiating in good faith on the legislative side. And I'm talking about Republicans. This isn't just Democrats, where we obviously already know have a vested interest in making sure that this president does not succeed. We have Never Trumpers, some people in other places that definitely would like to not see the president's agenda succeed, not because they don't want specifically just for his philosophy to not succeed. They personally don't want him to succeed.
True.
I think that I agree with what Ray said. And I think what's going on here is that Trump made the decision to bring in Kelly because he finally came to the realization he got rolled by the Republicans in Congress. They tricked him, basically, and just played him for a rube and basically said to him, "You just back off. We'll handle this." And that won't stand with a guy like this. That they don't understand. They do not understand what they've got on their hands. Just like the opposition didn't understand during the primaries and then during the general election. They don't know what they've got on their hands. He's not one of them. And it's become a politics.
But you know what's odd about this? Trump is so unfiltered. He's a kid in a candy. He's a what do they say? A elephant in the candy store.
He's on a first name basis with McConnell.
He is a street fighter. He's a ruffian. Mm-hmm. He's unfiltered. He's a kid in a candy store. He's the elephant in the living room. He is completely without boundaries.
He's a technocrat.
There's days he can't put a damn sentence together, I swear. And then you've got the complete opposite in John Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if John Kelly gets his nose bent out of shape, and it's possible, I mean, even military guys get finally exasperated, and he is retired, right? Then it will look really bad for Trump.
It will.
Because the optics right now is that I can control the mad dog in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. I'm the guy who's his rock of Gibraltar. I'm the guy who's his anchor. I'm the wind bit beneath his wings to help him out when he's stumbling and so forth. I am the guardian angel, so to speak. But he's blowing through people really fast.
And truth be told, this is not anything it's revolutionary. There has been tons of administrations that have burned through people who are part of the campaign that burned out very quickly in the beginning of the actual administration. But like I said before, Kelly's real telltale sign of success for him is not just going to be how he allows the president to continue what he loves to do best, which is tweet in his own voice and what have you, not to interfere with that, but to have some kind of a part in legislative success for the president's agenda and to make sure that the leaks stop and to connect and court.
Well, to that point then, legislative success, John, what do you see that as? He's a military guy.
Well, but he...
So is he helping with all of this push into Afghanistan now?
There's no question about it. I think that's the reason that Trump picked him, because he was the liaison to Congress under the CIA director and the liaison to Congress under the defense secretary. Under Gates and under Panetta, he was the congressional liaison for the Defense Department, Secretary of Defense, and for the director of the CIA. So he knows these clowns, okay? He knows them up one side and down the other. He's conveyed that to Trump. And I think there was some point in this drama where he conveyed to Trump, "You're being rolled."
Mm.
And that's really going to be important to recognize in the new battles that are coming forward, because as the Senate dropped the ball when it came to Obamacare, repeal and replace, the new battle is going to be now. And Trump has basically already announced it that, you know, if we don't get funding for the wall, there's going to be a government shutdown. That's what he's basically saber-rattling with as of right now. And Ryan obviously was going to go out there and probably be the first one to respond and saying, you know what, it's not necessary, we don't need this, and it's probably not what the American people want. But this is going to be the new test of how effective Kelly can be on that front, which is a huge front, but also the other one that hasn't made a lot of buzz, funnily enough, right now because of what happened in Charlottesville, is the leaking. The leaking has to not only stop.
It's got to stop. It absolutely has to stop.
To be prosecuted.
And interestingly, absolutely. And thrown in federal prison.
Correct.
Absolutely. But interestingly enough, is it that we're not hearing it because we've had Charlottesville and
yes,
we've had all this Boston and so forth? or and Afghanistan and then the rally in Phoenix and all of this that dominates. Is there still leaking going on?
Oh, absolutely.
We, the people, don't know because we see everything through a box.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, true, on the internet and so forth. But I believe there is more happening, whether or not it is even if it's a little bit, of course, it's wrong. But some is larger and more vindictive than others.
Yes.
And all right, let me move on in the interest of time. What about this, John? What about holding him back with the tweeting? I think most people are getting used to the tweets, but they don't like this aspect. They don't like it when Trump gets in the weeds. Stay on the fairway. Talk about Afghanistan. Talk about getting repeal and replace again. But don't crab about Mika Brzezinski. Don't crab about Mitch McConnell. Don't crab about Jeff Sessions. That's in the weeds. People don't like that. The optics are not good. Rise above it.
I think that I don't think it'll ever happen, number one. Number two, I think it's missing the point about the tweets. This man, Obama tweeted, right? And he did exactly what you said. Message discipline, stayed in his lane. Nobody ever talked about him. This man, what he did this past week, he talked directly, not just through his tweets, but in that event in Phoenix, he talked directly to the American people in the kind of colloquial language that they understood. And that's what he is doing. That's what he is doing. He's got he and Bannon had they were soul brothers in a lot of things. This guy, among other things, besides returning prosperity and all that, he's going to go take out the media and he's going to take out the educational establishment next. And he's not going to stop.
Everybody that's been waiting around for this pivot shoe to drop has been basically just waiting for the wrong thing to happen. It's never going to happen. Everybody that has thought that candidate Trump was going to somehow transition all of a sudden into their idea of what presidential Trump should be is very ill-informed and very much ill-advised of expecting that. He is going to continue on this trajectory with respect to his communication. There's no reason why he should stop. All the polling that said that he was going to lose is the same kind of polling right now that's telling him that his numbers are in the tanks and that he's basically better change trajectory. Otherwise, he's going to cost his party elections next year and is going to basically put his own reelection
in jeopardy. Except for one thing. He can learn on the job. And in doing the job, that blonde hair will turn a little bit more gray.
He'll dye that. He'll never allow that to happen.
Look at Obama. Look at George W. Bush. Look at all of them. They tire and they get seasoned at the same time. So even though he's unfiltered and ruffian and all the adjectives, and there's so many, I mean, I heard just recently he's just a buffoon. All right. And then the woman who told me that, she says, but he's a brilliant buffoon.
But let's never forget that he's also a technocrat. He has never held any political office before this.
True.
First technocrat in the office since George Washington.
But if we expect all of this, what we saw on the campaign trail, to last through 4 years, no, he will change.
Time will tell.
He will. He will change. So I'll challenge you on that.
All right.
I'm Terry Gilbert. You're listening to Think America. Reason first, then converse.
If you've ever wanted to know just how the free market will save America's economy, you need Hillsdale's Economics 101 right away. With 10 absolutely free weekly lectures, you can view at your own convenience, and weekly Q&A sessions with Hillsdale's professors, Economics 101 will teach you all the nuts and bolts of free market capitalism. If you think the left's government-down economic policy is all wrong for America, but can't quite explain why, this crash course in free market economics is something you should take. After you register, you can find out how to get your own copy of A Capitalist Manifesto, written by Economics 101 professor Dr. Gary Wolfram. Activate your free Economics 101 course now. Go to hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale.edu. That's hillsdale.edu. And learn how the free market will save America's economy. Hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
If you're new to the show and you want to follow the show, thinkamericaradio.com is where to go. There's a number of past archive shows that are there. You can hear all of my town hall guests as well as myself Find me there. You can also find me on Facebook, terrytalkradio.com. Should professional cheerleaders be paid? This is a really interesting, thought-provoking question. Why? Because more and more of the cheerleaders are making it known that they need to be paid or paid better for their services. Many of them barely earn minimum wage. Of course, it depends on the team. But typically, they make per game anywhere between $75 a game to $150 a game. Now, you might say, well, they're $150, you know, all they had to do is just dance a little bit, $150 richer. Well, good for them. And yet, you're not, if you think that way, you're not taking into consideration the hours spent perfecting choreography, creating routines, practice in the gym, constantly being in shape. It's exhausting. And in the NFL and the NBA, those players, as we all know, take away millions. But here's the argument the cheerleaders are making. We help bring in the crowds that pay those millions because we're beautiful. We're out there with our routines and we're shaking a leg, if not shaking other things. What do you say, Ray?
I think if that was the case, and they should have their own leagues of cheerleaders. If that was truly the case, that they were bringing in the people just to see them, or if they were a significant factor in coming in to see the games, they should create their own sport, pure cheerleading, get stadiums funded in cities around the country, and have people go and spectate sport.
Perhaps. But why don't they just get paid something more than $100 a night on a game on average? Really?
Truth be told, this is a similar argument that's made in a lot of other jobs that are not meant to be careers. This is not a career. This lasts, at best, probably 3 or 4 years.
Were brain surgeons. Come on.
But the thing that it is going to get them is connectivity, something that will be a career.
Really?
They're looking to get noticed. That's
really?
Why do you think they do this? Why do you think they know what they're going to get
Maybe
paid?
Maybe they like dancing.
No.
I'm being devil's advocate big time here.
They know what they're going to get before they start the job. Nobody goes into a job that's basically said, oh, surprise, you're going to get paid $12 today. They know that they're going to get this, and they go to this so that they can get connectivity with other opportunities, whether it be acting, modeling, singing. There's always people that are
Law
scouting.
Law school.
Yeah, right. You know, Harvard's always scouting these events.
You know, I've got a bit of a different take on it. There was an article last week, the week before, that the commissioner of the NFL has taken home an average of $20 million a year for 10 years. And he's an empty suit. He's just a towel boy.
Isn't that what Condoleezza Rice wants?
He's an empty suit. He's just a towel boy for Bob Kraft and Jerry Jones and the rest of them. And what you've got here is you're absolutely right, Ray, about what they do. But there's a couple of missing ingredients. One is they use these cheerleading squads out in the community, and they do a lot of schools, they do a lot of hospitals, that type of thing.
Personal appearances.
That's personal appearances, and that builds fan loyalty. And there is, you know, it's an intangible, I'll grant you, hard to draw one line between the other. The second thing is that the reason they used to be so attractive was they could get a husband. That doesn't apply anymore, right? So they really might be law school, but they're doing it exactly for what he said, connections and all the rest. But the value proposition has changed. And the value proposition is that these guys, with all the players that won't kneel and the drugs and beating up women and all the rest, they need those cheerleaders out there talking to the school kids and going.
And have
to
you noticed Condoleezza Rice isn't exactly going to jazz classes?
Well,
now, is she? She's a smart woman and she knows where the money is. Yeah. $20 million to be the commissioner? Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't see her, you know, shaking the booty and, you know, going to jazz classes with the pom-poms.
Truth be told, we could look at the top of any organization and see an empty suit and say, why is that guy making that much money or getting his golden parachute or doing this and that? The market dictates it.
So fair point.
I have never been in the opinion where we should be dictating to any industry what people should be making, because that is a dangerous slope to be on, to say that, okay, you're putting in a lot of work, so therefore you merit this amount, and the guy who's 10 steps above you, he's not doing anything, but he's making millions. How is this right? This appeals to our emotion, obviously, because we look at things in a very black and white way of saying that, oh, that's evil. No, it is what the market dictates in that industry.
All right, let's say, to your point, because you're making good points, let's say there are no more cheerleaders. Let's say the NFL or the NBA or any association says, okay, we're not going to have this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Do we think fewer people will be watching NBA games?
Only at the Cowboy games. Not NBA games.
Because you sounded like Trump there for a minute.
No,
only
no,
Rosie O'Donnell.
No, the reason why I say that is the Cowboys, actually, funnily enough, are the only one that actually had a team. They got a TV show. The Cowboys cheerleaders got a TV show on cable, and they basically show the entire spread of how they went from training to formation to the selection of the couch casting, as you might want to call it, however you want to
casting
do it.
Casting couch.
Casting couch. That's how they did it, and they showed from A to B how you become a cheerleader for the Dallas Cowboys. And so that is probably the only team that really has the corner on the market of identity of a team's cheerleaders, whereas the rest of the teams that just happen to have cheerleaders.
And people would still go into the stands whether or not there was cheerleaders down on the floor or not.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think what Ray said is true, except I disagree with the market part. These people, the NFL is basically a legally sanctioned monopoly. It's not a market. There's no market there. So they set that rate. Now, what's going to happen is they're going to give up their tax-exempt status because they're making so dadgum much money, and then maybe some market forces will come into play, but I don't see it at the moment.
Well, when you're talking about these women going out and reading to kids in hospitals or playing Mrs. Santa Claus
USO.
Or whatever in the Christmas parades or all of that is time consuming too, and they're neat because that does help market the teams. So I say they need to be paid far more than $100 a game. There you go.
110.
All right. One cent or 110. Oh yeah, all right.
Big spender
cheap
over
skate,
here.
Cheapskate. When we come back, a parenting expert talking about how to talk to your kids about bigotry. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
Over the last couple of weeks, we've been witnessing what happened in Charlottesville in Virginia and at the University of Virginia, and then fallout from that went to Boston and other places, including a little in Oakland, I'm told. And also there was a huge rally in Phoenix. Now, not bloodshed in the streets, because Phoenix, of course, had a massive police presence. Other places didn't. But nonetheless, we're seeing all of this in America today. Not just adults, but kids too. And they turn away from the TV and they say, Dad, why does everybody hate each other? I go to school. I don't hate my classmates. Well, what is this hate? So I thought it would be prudent to bring Harry Harrison Jr. on board in my interview. He is a parenting expert, and he's the author of several best-selling books, including Fearless Parenting, Raising a Child to Face the Adult World. Specifically on the topic of how do you talk to your kids about hate? How do you talk to your kids about bigotry? Hello, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Terry. Great to be here. Thanks so much.
You bet. All right. Where do we begin with all of this? Do we talk about the Deep South? Do we talk about Lee? Do we talk about the North-South Pride? Do we talk about slavery? Do we talk about black versus white? Do we talk about Trump versus Obama? I mean, it's so charged. Where would you start if your child said, Daddy, what does bigotry mean?
I'll tell you what I think. What we're witnessing is what happens when a whole country starts going with bad parenting and not teaching honor and not teaching respect and not teaching love. And these rioters have no base. So now they're screaming, epithets at each other, and a child wanders in. He may hear it on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I hope he doesn't, but he may hear this at school, which I hope she doesn't. The parents just have to sit down and tell them, there are people who are just uncomfortable. There are people who don't like each other, and they take it out on others. And the hate is not good, which you see on TV is not good. And this is why we really want to concentrate on loving the other person, on bringing parenthood into the family, bringing the traditions back into the family, bringing respect and honor and all the things back to the family. I don't see you talking to a four-year-old about hate and bigotry. I wouldn't even bring that up. But inevitably, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old may start wondering what bigotry is.
Mm-hmm.
And as parents, we have to be laser focused that it is not a good thing.
Well, you say this stems from bad parenting. I couldn't agree with you more. But some kids don't get the luck of having good parents. And since hate, a lot, yes, hate, bigotry, that's all learned. So
absolutely.
The fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. What do you say to this audience, this national audience that hears our talk right now, and they know in their hearts, some of them, they're bad parents. They know in their hearts, some of them, They're racist. They know in their hearts, some of them, they're bigots. They know in their hearts, some of them, that they're teaching that just through osmosis to their children in subtle ways.
You know, what's terrible is you put a collection of four-year-olds together, black, white, brown, different cultures, different religions, they all get along.
True.
But what you were saying is so right. We teach our children to hate. We teach them to be bigoted. We teach them to be prejudiced. And then when something like these riots happen, we're all wondering, well, how did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
How did my child become this guy knocking people around in downtown street? Bigotry is learned at the feet of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And the like you said, people are very, they're not aware of what they're saying. They're not aware of the generalizations they make. And it's really up to parents to start turning the conversation, looking at the way we talk around our kids, looking at the way we talk when they're around, the way we talk to waiters, the waitresses, the way we talk about cops, the way we talk about the other cultures, the way we talk about other religions.
I want to pick up on that because therein lies a lot of the problem. Many people aren't aware themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't just with bigotry with regard to black and white issues. It could be sexism as well. You know, the way men talk to women about women sometimes, they think, oh, that's okay. It was just, you know, a little locker room talk. That's no big deal. Or, well, using the N-word. Oh, well, my pappy used to say that. Or whatever it might be. People, first of all, are in denial because many times they, in their minds, aren't aware that they're bigoted themselves, Harry, number one.
No.
And number two, I think sometimes what happens is, well, they deserved it after all, and they make excuses. In other words, they're going to go ahead and get that N-word in or say something really sexist or very mean or demeaning, like he doesn't make enough money or he's a poor slob or whatever it is, to create this prejudice in the home, depending upon where your biases may fall. And then when called on it, by somebody nicely, let's say a neighbor calls you on it or whatever, you go, well, now they get all defensive, right?
Right.
Because, well, they deserved it. Anybody running around in a miniskirt, well, she deserves it. You know, we hear this. So could you address those two pieces?
Well, the first thing, my wife is from Montana, and she moved to Dallas as a fourth grader, and people threw spitballs at her. Other kids, because she was from the north, and they were from the south here.
But they're both Western towns.
I know, but she talked funny. So again, bigotry is learned at the parents' lap. And I think that if we started consciously watching, and this is hard to do, Terry, we started consciously watching how we talk about each other around our kids, how we refer to each other, how we show the mom respect, how we show women respect, how do we show other cultures respect. And this is something that should just be talked about every day. I mean, we can read books to our children about other cultures. We can take them to motion pictures and see about other cultures. There's so many ways that we can communicate. This is a big, wide world. There's a lot of different people in it,
mm-hmm.
and that's fine. It's just fine. Not everybody's going to look like you or think like you or sound like you, and that's fine.
The common thread that comes through everything you're saying, honor, love, respect, and looking at differences, but all of this has to come down to civility and manners.
Absolutely.
You might, if you're a Jew, you might not agree with Catholics, for example, or might not agree with Muslims, but there has to be common courtesy, manners, civility. And we've lost this as well, Harry. It breaks my heart the way people behave with each other on the freeway or at a Safeway or in the public square, even in churches. If you don't go to my church, something's wrong with you.
I know.
What has happened to our culture? We're so diverse, and yet we're finding compliments within our own little nucleus. And if
that
you're
is,
not in that I, nucleus, you're the outlier and we don't like you. I see it every day.
It's like we practice duality with our kids. This is good. This person's good. This person's bad. This religion's good. This religion's bad. This state is good. This state is bad. These politics are good. These politics are bad.
And yet, Harry, I want to be clear. It doesn't mean anything goes either. When the KKK shows up, the new KKK, the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, that doesn't mean anything goes in a riot. Now, they did have a permit to walk. But the minute somebody crosses the line into illegality on either side, I say you're arrested. You go in the paddy wagon. You go into jail, and probably for a long time. But concentrate a little bit in the time that we have left about this doesn't mean anything goes either.
No. When we teach our children civility, we should also teach them to stand up for the other person. I mean, you know, it comes down to right and wrong. You know, it's wrong to carry torches and attack people in the street. And it's wrong for the KKK to be marched around. And this is teaching our kids not only about civility and manners, but what's right. What do you do when you see something wrong going on? Do you just turn your eyes and not watch it?
But at least, Harry, you say torches and marching around. Having a torch is not illegal. It might be foul. It might be disgusting. Walking around Charlottesville is not illegal when you have a permit. And somebody authorized that group at the University of Virginia to be there on a Friday night, which echoed for many people that look of lynching.
Yeah.
I mean, all of that is not illegal. It's foul. It's very foul. And it's very, very suggestive.
And it's immoral. It's just flat immoral.
Exactly. Thank you. But it's not illegal. So we use our laws as well as mores, as well as civility, as well as all of our manners and so forth to keep us in check. And boy, oh boy, has it really gotten into the legalities now. And some people say, I don't care about the law either. I'll still fight in the street. And that's what happened in Charlottesville.
That's what happened. And this is what happens when we don't teach our kids about honor, about respect, about love. I mean, it seems so basic, Terry, but we have lost it. Today's parents have lost that, and yesterday's parents have lost it.
What about K through 12? Have we lost it in our public schools?
We have not lost it up to about second grade, probably. But then our kids start hearing the way we talk. They start hearing the way we compare one culture to another culture or one person to another person. They start hearing mm-hmm. this. And you know, they hear it around the dinner table. They hear it in the car. They start just picking up on what our parents say. And then we just parrot it back. By 10 years old, we're just parroting back what our parents say.
Mm-hmm. We need to leave it there, Harry. Harry Harrison Jr., he's the author of Fearless Parenting, Raising a Child to Face the Adult World. Great topic. And I'm so glad for all your pointers and tips. Thank you, Harry, very much. We'll talk to you in another segment down the road, I'm sure.
Thank you, Terry.
Straight ahead, let's talk about Far Out here on Think America with Terry Gilbert.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
All right, good tips from Harry Harrison. Bad parenting teaches bigotry. I guess that's it in a nutshell. So be a good parent. Love, honor, respect, cultural mores, follow the law, be civil, all of that. Ray.
I think a mistake that's being made here, though, with respect to the idea of bigotry and racism is that it's formulated in your childhood. Let's take, for example, what just recently happened with Robert Lee from ESPN.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Robert Lee is an Asian American.
Mm-hmm.
Asian Americans, like Hispanic Americans, which happen to be more numerous than African Americans, both get lost in this dichotomy of race relations because even in this conversation that happened a little while ago, it was black and white. The discussion is always black and white. It's never including any other culture. So fast forward to Robert Lee, who's neither black nor white, but happens to have a name. It's Robert Lee. And what are not only his family going to think about with respect to, in the least amount, they're going to think that, okay, African-Americans are thin-skinned, or are they going to all of a sudden become in their adult stage of life like, I hate these stereotypes mm-hmm. that I see of African-Americans. Mm-hmm. I am now a racist.
Well, Charlottesville was black and white.
Correct. But the rest of the country is not
Charlottesville. But now he gets caught up in that, I understand. Right.
Well, I think that the main lesson that came through for me in that discussion was how important it is to stay focused and to stay kind when you're dealing with your children.
Mm.
The crimes we commit against children are numerous, and a lot of them are inadvertent. But the idea that that we have so much power, sometimes we forget that. And that
good
was a good reminder.
So. Let me get to Megan now. Megan is waiting on the line. Megan, I know you didn't hear the interview, so we'll move on to the other topic I wanted to talk to you about. And that has to do with the rage that is resurfacing with regard to outer space. This past week was an enormous week for people in the United States. I mean, I think the whole country was abuzz with a solar eclipse. Here's the question. Are we going to get the rage going with things far out, as in space exploration?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, for sure. I mean, we're seeing a ton of private industry companies coming out and jumping on board with space exploration. I mean, I just I was looking at lists of it, Terry, and there's lists and lists and lists of people who are engaging, whether it's Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or any of the SpaceX programs that we're seeing. And what we're finding, Terry, is that they're more efficient and that they are more effective, right, with these private industry companies coming in. So I think that many libertarians, although everybody loves space exploration, and you may not, well, you probably do know this about me, Terry, because I talk about it all the time, about how I really, really want to go into outer space. And the idea and the reason why I'm so supportive of us moving to privatizing space exploration is because I think that it would be more likely to happen than it would with the federal government. And when we look at some of these situations, like, we're really, really excited, we're really proud that we landed on the moon. But really, the point of that was to show off to our neighbors, right? We were trying to overcome the Russians in that race. It had nothing to do with space exploration. It was a contest. It was trying to show who was the biggest guy on the block.
Well, so it was keeping up with the Joneses, for sure. But to keep up with the Joneses and to beat out the Joneses, we had to explore.
Right, but we had to do it with other people's money, right? We had to do it with taxpayers' money, which is part of the issue that we have here. When we look at some of these bloated departments within the federal government, unfortunately, NASA is also one of them. And what we're going to see is, just like the post office, once we had FedEx and we had alternatives that were out there, we're going to see some innovation. We're going to see things that are much more efficient. And the post office, NASA, just like the post office, is going to be like that sad entity in the corner that everybody goes, oh gosh, it's so depressing, we don't want to have.
So when I ask, so if I were to ask you, Megan, whether you lean for or against spending that increases NASA's exploration, you would say against, but spending needs to be increased in the private sector.
Oh, definitely, 100%. Now, a lot of these large companies, these private companies that are engaging in space exploration, they do rely heavily upon grants and monies from NASA. But I think what we'll see is that once NASA, the spending is cut with NASA, and I would actually, I mean, again, libertarians, we aren't all or nothing on this one, but I would much rather see that money going towards private practice instead of that bureaucracy, where we might actually see some innovation and something really happening for us to actually get out and start having maybe recreational travel. We might be able to explore Mars. I think we will see more of that stuff happening with private practice. So, yes, 100%.
Well, perhaps, yeah, yes, perhaps
spending.
So. I find it a little ironic that President Obama, which he just spent like there was no tomorrow, and everything got more bloated with the federal government, and you and I have both talked about that ad nauseum, that we're both against that, found there was very little interest in NASA. And yet President Trump, that wants to make America great again by cutting things and trying to work on the federal budget more than Obama ever did, is for space exploration. And I've got friends at NASA, and they say, we love President Trump for this, because finally NASA is now back on the map, so to speak. So I find that kind of ironic. We'll pick it up on the backside of this break. You're listening to Think America, Reason First and Then Converse. ThinkAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
It's probably been a while since you've heard far out, and now people are maybe starting to say it again, and that's with interest in space. Congress slowed the roll with NASA during President Obama's terms in office, citing costs to explore the universe. But President Trump is a go. Ray, good, bad? Are you for exploration, spending all that money, or are you like to tighten the belt?
I would say this first. I'm a psychotically conservative guy, and I would definitely say that that economically conservative is definitely not out of that realm of my conservatism. But that being said, there are aspects of space exploration that are not just for the sake of exploration that the country benefits from directly. One is the technology that's developed from space exploration via NASA gets basically given to the country for free. It's not patented. It's given to the American economy, such as what we take for granted every day, our microwave ovens, freeze-dried food, what have you. on the second point is really essentially forgotten by a lot of people who talk about bloating budgets and what have you. The first responsibility of every government, even a libertarian, will tell you is to protect the country. There are defense aspects to what NASA does that other countries are definitely engaging in. China, Russia, even the European Union. There are defense aspects to their space exploration that cannot be overlooked, that Elon Musk and all the other private entrepreneurs are never going to not only not do, but even if they develop something that would be defense focused, would never just hand over to the United States. They're going to hand over to the highest bidder. So there's definitely a necessity of maintaining a very well-funded NASA in the defense of in the interest of national defense, as well as the development of the technology that basically gets us to those places like Mars or the moon again. Those technologies are then turned back into the American economy that allows us to produce products that make us not only the innovators of the world, but also let our economy benefit from the products that are developed
and
here.
And that falls in line with your conservative thinking.
Absolutely.
Does it fall in line with yours? Are you a conservative, John?
Yeah, I'm more of a libertarian than a conservative, and I would agree in broad terms with what Ray said. The NASA's role needs to change. They need to be more of a facilitator of space exploration as well as space exploitation. So therefore, the defense aspect of it, they absolutely, 100%. The pursuit of the leading technology, maybe. But as far as the rest of it goes, let's go and mine an asteroid. Let them have at it. Because the guys that are doing it now will do it. Yeah. What Trump is doing, though, is he's old school. By the way, he's not a conservative. He's a Democrat. But he's old school. Musk and the rest of them still want to get their subsidies from NASA and their tax breaks from the federal government, and that's what Trump is talking about.
That should definitely not happen. That's where I would disagree with the president on that front. I wouldn't want to see any private industry getting subsidies to do something that they're going to only directly benefit from and not turn over that technology, not only not turn over that technology that's produced to the American economy, but also not turn over any kind of defense possibilities specifically only to the United States. Yeah, that would be the tit for tat. If they're going to be contracting for the federal government on a defense platform, then that's another issue. We have plenty of companies that do that right now already that are private companies that contract with the federal government with respect to defense. But if that's not the issue, then they should not be getting federal money that's going to come back to the American taxpayer.
I couldn't agree more. Good points all. Megan, I know you heard all of that under the segment of Change Your Life Technology to take us out of this hour. Are you going to be talking about space technology?
Well, I'm definitely talking about the sun, and I'm talking about solar energy. So, I mean, that might actually count.
That was the hot item this week, wasn't it? The sun.
Yeah, it was exciting. So many exciting discoveries are going to come out of this eclipse. I'm really, really stoked to kind of read all of the different things that people are going to be finding out about the corona. And I'm not going to nerd out on you here, Terry, but let's go ahead and transition into the photovoltaic module that they're installing on a Prius. Now, Panasonic has just unveiled an improved solar panel. And this may seem like it's not that big of a deal, because right now the solar panel is capable of producing 56 watts of power, which really is only enough to charge the ventilation system in your car, but not the car's battery. But what Toyota is saying now is that they can actually add a range on the miles that they're able to get currently. And what it will allow them to do is to increase the amount of time that you get on your electric vehicle. So it's a small breakthrough, but what they're doing is they're making use of energy that they're already harvesting, which we've talked about in the past is very difficult. They lose a lot of that energy that they end up harnessing from the sun. So this way we're getting closer and closer and closer to being able to take advantage of that energy that they get.
Fascinating. Tell me again, photovoltaic modular.
A photovoltaic module for automobile. And it's HIT, HIT is the name that they've actually trademarked on this one. And it's going to extend the life of your car battery, basically. And Tesla is looking at it, which makes sense because Panasonic has already been providing Tesla with solar and battery cells.
So interesting. Quick, while we take you up to the top of the show and have to say goodbye, did you just love the solar eclipse or what?
I loved it, Terry. I can't even tell you. In fact, I've been watching shows on it ever since the solar
really?
Eclipse.
You're a hip gal, Megan. You are Megan the Millennial. Yeah. All right. Very good. Thank you so much. I want to say thank you to John for playing Think America. Thank you to Ray for playing. You both pulled the long straws, I guess. All right. We really liked your input. I'm Terry Gilbert. Remember, reason first and then converse. See you next time.
Welcome to Think America. with Terry Gilbert.
Well, it is back to school, back to books, and back to teachers panhandling for supplies. Should teachers who feel they need extra school supplies be out on the street corners and near freeway off-ramps to get money to buy school supplies? What is wrong with this picture, America? And speaking of school, making school friends and standing up to bullies. I'll have an interview on how kids really cope now that they're getting back into the school routine. Plus, monkey see, monkey do, monkey takes a selfie, and then monkey owns the right to the selfie. Really? That's what the people at PETA think. What do you think? We'll talk about it on the program. Hello there, Terry here on Think America, where we reason first and then converse. I'm Terry Gilbert. This is America's Town Hall. I present thought-provoking conversation starters to two Americans who are not broadcasters, but they drew the long straw to come into the studio. One is Ray. He is an HR professional. Nice to have you, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And the other is John. He is retired and he was a consultant, real estate.
In real
and,
estate,
middle and
estate
an among investor. Other things,
but yeah, and now I'm just a retired investor.
Well, I'm
living
glad,
on a pension.
I'm glad you're both and living on all your millions, I'm sure. I'm glad you're both into the studio. We want to say before we start today a shout out to Cadillac, Michigan, and Hastings, Michigan, WATT AM 1240. Nice to have you part of Think America, and WBCH AM 1220. Welcome aboard. Quickly. Get into this big topic. I've been dying to get into this topic. There are so many distractions, and that's what President Trump is up against. Not to mention, he distracts himself. Many Republicans worry about all the things that draws away from President Trump's focus, President Trump's agenda. He got into the office with a mandate from the people to change the way things are done in Washington. First of all, to drain the swamp. That's deep state stuff. Second of all, repeal and replace Obamacare. That hasn't happened. Cut taxes. I hope we're getting there. Anyway, build the wall. That hasn't happened yet. Defeat ISIS. Well, now we've got a push in Afghanistan, but that's really against the Taliban now, isn't it? I mean, how are we doing with the ISIS thing? Create jobs. Well, he has done some of that. Care for the vets. On and on. In short, make America great again. But distractions abound. Mainstream media, academia, Hollywood, and tools like Twitter, Ray. Sometimes he's his own worst enemy. Focus, focus, focus. Can he focus?
I don't think it's really necessary in order for him to be able to say that he's focused or not focused to qualify that by his tweets or not tweeting. I think what's really in play here is the fact that, for example, when it comes to repeal and replace, 7 years of voting in the House of repeal and they have no plan for him to basically just coast into and basically wait in his office to sign the bill that they were cooking up for 7 years. He doesn't need to have any distractions or lack of distractions in order for them to do their job in the House and the Senate, in order for them to get that lined up, which they should have already had ready to bake for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And here he gets in office. They knew what his platform was on the campaign trail. He said it in no uncertain terms. We need to repeal and replace Obamacare.
They never thought he would
win. Exactly. That's the point.
So it was
not
verbal
that,
diarrhea from the right, from those Republicans.
Not only did they never think he was going to win, but it proves that they never had a plan if he did. They
Correctamundo.
Yeah, this is not political malpractice. It's political malfeasance. They have, like the rest of that swamp creatures, taking Americans for a ride. I disagree about the distraction part, in large part because if you look at Trump like a businessman and not one of these witch doctors that we elect, he's doing pretty well. For example, the regulation thing is working. They're repealing a lot of regulations. One reason the stock market is stable and is continuing to climb is he hasn't gotten a tax cut yet, but at least they know there's not going to be a tax increase. They understand that. The regulations are really freeing up. You talk to anybody in business right now, and they're going like, "Woo, we're starting to get some relief, and we know it won't get any worse." So then again, about focus, he said he was going to look at the Afghanistan and come up with a plan. By golly, he did. That's exactly what he did. He's got Kushner last week over in the Middle East talking with Abbas and with Netanyahu. So he seems to be getting a lot of things done. It's when he has to rely on those Republicans in Washington who do not want to change the way they're doing things. They how don't
do you,
like it.
A very good point, John. How do you feel, Ray, about a rally being a distraction? Why all these rallies? I love a rally. Who doesn't like a rally? But we've had so much of this on the campaign trail, and now there's more. And the people are of both sides of the coin on this. On the one hand, some people say, I love it. I get to see my president. He spoke to my heart. He's every man. He's brilliant. He puts it in lay speak. By goodness, that's the flyover states. And there's this guy, and to heck with the East and the West Coast. And he's a real, he's every man. And he kind of bumbles things out, but nobody cares. He just talks from his heart and from his gut. And I love it, and I'm inspired, and he's great. And this is Make America Great Again. He's the only guy for the job. And the other people go, why don't you stay in Washington and knuckle down and focus and get things done?
I think you're exhibiting the exact two-facedness of the people who would say both things, because that was a major criticism that both Democrats and Republicans had of the Trump selling the skinny repeal. Saying that he didn't go out to the people and he didn't actually talk to anybody, didn't hold rallies and didn't sell it. Obama went out when he was selling Obamacare and did multiple rallies around the country talking about the merits of Obamacare and what he's going to bring to the country. He sold this for about a year.
Good point.
This is what Trump needs to do in order to the wall, in order as president, not just as a candidate. Now, he's president, so he needs to go out and sell the wall. He needs to go out and sell the tax decrease. He needs to go out and sell that he's going to hold their feet to the fire, and that if that means primaries, and so be it. But the repeal and replace has to come, and he needs to talk to the people who are going to require
one of the things that he can't really sell because he can't get into it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he would be talking out of both sides of his mouth. Is he can't really sell Afghanistan. He can't really sell ISIS and that's, defeating ISIS because he doesn't want to script what we're doing. And so he soft pedals it. And then it's not really selling the American people on another couple of years, at least, of this long war.
That's also not another thing that's going to require a vote from Congress at this point. We're not talking about something that this pending legislation, other than maybe funding for the military. But with respect to an actual item that's pending, that's not at issue here.
Yeah, I the way I see it, he's up against the media, and he's up against his own party and the opposition party, and they're trying to form the narrative. If he didn't go out for a rally, who's going to speak up for him? Where's it going to come from? Where are you going to hear about it? He tweets, they distort those, they don't show all the tweets, right? If you follow him like I do on Twitter just to see what's going on, I mean, the guy just really likes the tweet, but if he didn't have these rallies, who would say that? There's no one out there to speak for him. And because he threatens the very livelihood and existence of the media and the politicians in Washington, they've united against him. There's a solid front. As far as Afghanistan goes, just drop one of those mother of all bombs again. That'll tell people that he's making some progress. That was spectacular. And that was a direct, you talk about focus, that was a direct result of focusing on what needed to be done, and that was turning those decisions over to the field commanders. And that's what they did. The first decision they made was to
drop
the bomb.
But my point is that it's one thing to try to sell the wall. It's another thing to sell war weary America that we're going to continue being at war, John.
I agree with that. And what I would say in his defense, and I'm not in the habit of defending him, but I think I can explain a little bit. What I would say is that he said very clearly in his address last week, the one that everybody's calling the calm one, the focused address, mm-hmm. What he said very clearly was, I didn't want to do this. It's against my basic instincts. I've been talking against the war for years and years and years, but this is what we're going to do. And so
did he sell it?
Well, I tell you what, I think
there was a rally this past week in Phoenix, and then he had a rally with vets. Did he sell it? We talk about rallies, right? To sell it. You made the astute point, Ray, about selling the wall, getting out there to rally. He's going to, just like Obama, you got to sell Obamacare or sell repeal. Did he sell it to the vets?
I think that the statement, the calm statement about I didn't want to do this, but I'm going to do it, sells it to a lot of people, and the rallies will sell it to a different audience.
On the defense issue, this is where he absolutely did sell it, which was with North Korea. He sold it with his not only his tweets, but his speeches, and said, we will have fire and I can't remember the
fury.
Exactly. And that didn't require
approval for Congress. Ray, I was waiting for the brimstone.
I know. Everybody in Guam was also too. But I think here's the issue.
I would lose my affiliate in Guam. Please
right?
stay with
exactly.
us.
But here's the issue. He sold it to Kim Jong-un. He sold it to the Chinese. He sold it to the Russians. There was unanimity on the Security Council and the UN to put new sanctions, whether or not they'll actually be enforced
and
is another
on that
issue.
Point, not to diverse too much, he got no victory lap.
Correct. He did not get a victory lap, not even from his own party. This is another thing why I'm saying it's important for him to do it, because Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, neither one of them are actually going out there and doing what he's doing. They're not barnstorming the country. They're national leaders, supposedly, on the congressional side. But they're not going out and selling the Republican agenda. It's only Trump that's doing this, because every success for him is something they do not want to see happen.
Well, and plus they're in a comfort zone. Ryan's was on tour last week. He was outselling his own tax plan that he's had for 5 years.
Nobody cares.
And yeah, exactly right. No one cares. But that's what he's outselling. He's not outselling, let's get America moving again. He's outselling the Ryan vision for the tax code.
He's the boy that couldn't.
He should have stayed on Ways and Means if he wants to be
absolutely
that nerdy. And the thing about what Trump has done is, once again, he's blessed by the enemies that he's got. They don't understand what's going on. They're still making the mistake they made in the campaign, which is they're taking him literally, right? Instead of taking him seriously. And that is that's the mistake they made in the campaign. So as a result, when he leaves out a phrase in a speech that he made, you know, when he was talking, when in that rally, he went on and on about what he said in the first statement, and the second about
Charlottesville,
yeah.
And he took out the piece of paper to deny the media.
Yeah, and then he left out a phrase in there. Well, they jumped all over that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take him literally. He's a businessman. He's used to using rhetoric to accomplish things. You can't take him literally.
He's not a good speaker, and they take him literally.
That's right, and they need to take him seriously, and that's what they're not doing.
And nor is Paul Ryan, and nor is Mitch McConnell, but I think those two guys need to pay attention to how Jeff Sessions handled getting punched in the nose by Donald Trump. Mitch McConnell is getting punched in the nose. He doesn't like it. John McCain got punched in the nose. He doesn't like it. Paul Ryan got some punch in the nose. These guys need to say, okay, Jeff Sessions sucked it up and is still on the team. Yeah. These guys, Ryan and Mitch McConnell, and even John McCain, for that matter, they punch back and they look dumb because they're punching back at our president now. Their president. It's no more campaign trail.
Well, and put it out of your mind,
they need to learn from Jeff Sessions.
Put it out of your mind that anybody like, for example, John McCain in the ancient years of his career that he's in right now, he has no incentive to. He's going to be here for on Earth less than the next term. So it doesn't matter for him. He's never going to change. Lindsey Graham, he's going to wane here and there whatever the polls are saying. But these people are not just entrenched. They're philosophically embedded against him. You will not change them.
Good points all. Good discussion. We move on to back to school and why are teachers panhandling for supplies in the classroom? What is wrong with this picture? We'll break it down for you on Think America. Reason first, then converse.
If you've ever wanted to know just how the free market will save America's economy, you need Hillsdale's Economics 101 right away. With 10 absolutely free weekly lectures, you can view at your own convenience, and weekly Q&A sessions with Hillsdale's professors, Economics 101 will teach you all the nuts and bolts of free market capitalism. If you think the left's government-down economic policy is all wrong for America, but can't quite explain why, this crash course in free market economics is something you should take. After you register, you can find out how to get your own copy of A Capitalist Manifesto, written by Economics 101 professor Dr. Gary Wolfram. Activate your free Economics 101 course now. Go to hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale.edu. That's hillsdale.edu. And learn how the free market will save America's economy. Hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilberg.
Well, I am very disturbed to learn that there are some teachers panhandling for supplies near freeway off-ramps and on street corners, and they have signs basically, give me money for my classroom. I'm a K through 12 school teacher. Some of these teachers say that they feel they need to do this because there just isn't enough money in the budget. And then, of course, the parents. They go to the Kmart, the Walmart, the Target, and they're supposed to load all up. And sometimes the parents say, why am I buying all this stuff? What happened to my taxpayer dollar K through 12? So apart from national defense and the daily federal government operations, education is a big bite out of the apple. We pay a lot for taxpayer in taxpayer dollar for our K through 12. What is wrong with this picture, John?
What's wrong with the picture is the fact that it's the government. I'm a big fan of universal education. I'm not a big fan of public education. This is part and parcel with having folks in missile silos that have computers that don't have the computing power of a Commodore 64. This is the part and parcel of our frontline forces in the Air Force and the Navy having to cannibalize equipment to get parts. It's government, it's not efficient, and so as a result, the teachers suffer. They spend more on administration, they spend more total on, per student than any place on earth, and the results aren't there. They're not there. And you have this kind of outcome where you've got teachers having to do this because they care about their job. They don't care about getting new carpeting in the school board office. They don't care about that. They care
don't
about
you think
job.
It's a little extreme, though, for a teacher
no.
to sit on an off-ramp of a freeway with a sign saying, give me money, here I am panhandling for school money?
What's being forgotten here is how everything gets funded. And it's not all the same. Every state is not the same. You have states
That's
like
true.
New Jersey, for example, that has an immense amount of infrastructure to feed their public schools programs and to feed their public school revenues. Where you have Western states that made a deal in their enactment when they became states in the first place that gave vast quantities of their state's territory to the federal government that they cannot raise revenues off of that go to fund public education. They cannot actually have tax revenues coming in and funding those classrooms. So they have to find it or they scrounge or they do whatever. But that is the difference. There's huge problems. And federal funding is very much not a factor when it comes to public education. It is local funding that actually feeds the public
schools. In addition,
schools.
True. Well, so what is the teacher supposed to do at the corner of a street corner?
Teacher,
go fund me sixth grade?
The teacher does what they have
go
to
fund me.
The teacher does what they have to because the decision isn't made at the teacher level, unfortunately. If it wasn't, I think a lot of teachers
I would be so embarrassed. I would not do that.
We'll work for pencils. Yeah, Ray's absolutely right about the structure and all that. But to my mind, it's symptomatic. If we took the money that was being spent, and in some states it's less than others, but if we were to take that money being spent and hand it to educators and say here, instead of to bureaucrats and say here, we would have different outcomes than we have now.
Well, I think the natural evolution that's going to happen there is when the public schools are put in direct competition with private schools and charter schools, and that's what's going to make them evolve or die. That's what's going to happen here. And the only way that that's going to be able to take place is if the private money or the public money that would go with that child that ordinarily would go to a public school, if it followed that child to a private school so that that kid that's stuck in that low-performing school in the barrio or the ghetto is able to go to a private school that's going to get him a better future, him or her a better future, that public money would follow them.
But, you know, teachers themselves, my mother was a school teacher, mm-hmm. and God rest her soul, so I'm not out for school teachers, but teachers themselves, through their unions, balk at that.
And that's the
they
other huge
thing.
They
fight all the time,
Here's
the
biggest
charter
problem
schools.
For the teachers is that they are beholden to whether they want to or not to the teachers' unions that, A, especially
exactly.
in conservative states,
I
will
agree.
Be the antithesis, the absolute enemy of most conservative lawmakers who would basically, just on the surface, see a teacher
I
union
agree.
Or some teacher
I
and
agree.
Say, I don't want to fund you. You're not only going to ask for more money at legislative time for budget for education, but you're also going to support my candidate in the general election. You're going to go out and support the Democrat. So why would I ever be convinced to give more money to public education that's going to have more
coffers? I know there should never be this political cash.
Correct.
But what about this element, John? They're out there, some of them, not all teachers, but some of them are panhandling. How do we know that at the end of the day, especially if the teacher is attractive and they like her sign and she's creative with the sign and all all of that.
That sells
that,
itself.
That she may make $400 or $500 and just pocket it.
She?
He. He.
I mean, come on.
There are pretty
okay,
men out here.
Androgynous.
One of them sitting right here.
A she-he. A he-she. Everybody that wants to get they, out there
right,
and,
pronouns.
And call themselves a teacher.
They or zeer, please. We don't know that. My tendency is to believe that it's so common that I don't think I'd get rich off of palming pencils. And I mean, what are you going to do? Put
no,
them on
you're
eBay?
Making money here. You know, you pull up at the freeway off of the off ramp and there's a sign and I need money for school supplies. All right. Well, here's $10. OK, it's not that high. Give me pencils. It's high. I need money for school supplies. I'm bringing up just the other element that people who criticize this are saying there's how do we know that that person is a teacher and how do we know that that person isn't pocketing the money?
You never even know if that person is actually even in need. But that's not
exactly.
the issue here.
Exactly.
If it's true need, if it's true absolute desire to come up with the shortcomings of the public education system, it's just like with everything else. The old axiom is all politics are local. Same holds true for public education. When it comes to public education, the issues and the problems are local. So if you have public leaders who are interested in resolving this issue, you need to figure out how the spending is allocated to the child, to each classroom, and then figure out what's the best way to do that. Should we continue to just dump money into public education, or should we make public education compete with private and with charter
schools. And have every child be an individual, I want to add as well. Well, good luck, teachers. If you can get out there and make some money and get it into more pencils and more books and more lined paper and even, smart boards, good for you. More power to you. I don't think I could ever see myself doing that. Straight ahead, let's talk more school on Growing Friendships, A Kid's Guide to Making and Keeping Friends, a hot book that's been out for a while, Making School Friends and Standing Up to Bullies, when we return.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
I'm delighted to bring to the microphone Dr. Eileen Kennedy Moore. She's a PhD child psychologist and the author of Growing Friendships, A Kid's Guide to Making and Keeping Friends. Why? Because it's now back to books, back to school, back to getting into the routine of the fall. School is upon us, even though, you know, most of the time it's supposed to be when I was growing up after Labor Day, but it isn't. Kids are going back earlier and earlier. And then how do they adjust? They've got to make friends, but they also have to stand up to bullies. So how to cope? Hello, Dr. Kennedy Moore. How are you? Thanks for doing the show.
Hi, Terry. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So we're back to school, back to books, back to teachers' dirty looks and all of that. And also, let's start with the standing up to bullies. That is a big one because making friends is easier for a lot of kids, I would say, maybe in general. But standing up to a bully, that can get a real nerve-wracking. There's a lot of angst to that. Let's start with that one. How to do it?
Well, Terry, I think it's really important to distinguish between bullying versus ordinary meanness. And researchers have a very specific definition of bullying. So it's deliberate meanness targeted at a particular individual, usually over a period of time, although sometimes a particularly mean act can count. Mm. But the other important feature of bullying is that there's a power difference between the kid being targeted and the kid doing the bullying. And that's really important because kids do a lot of things that are mean. You know, their empathy isn't fully developed, and they're experimenting with social power. So there was one study where the researchers talked to teachers and identify the kids who were especially aggressive and the kids who were especially non-aggressive. Mm-hmm. And then they got permission, I don't know how, but they got permission to videotape these kids or video record these kids on the playground. And what they found is that those especially aggressive kids did some kind of mean thing every 2 minutes. Mm. But those especially non-aggressive kids, they did something mean about every 3 minutes. So we're talking like pretty minor meanness, like, no, you can't, or play, or I was here first, or something like that. But I think it's really important that we distinguish between the ordinary meanness, which kids need to learn how to handle on their own, and the true bullying, which is there's the power difference, and adults really needs to step in.
Well, that may be, but it's hard to know, and certainly a kid doesn't know. Half the time, parents don't know. I know in sixth grade, that's a turning point for a lot of young girls, for example. The change of life, the menstruation starts to happen earlier rather than in eighth grade. It's earlier because of the hormones in our food, and they turn into mean girls, Eileen, at sixth grade. And between fifth grade and sixth grade, what happened, right? Maybe it's because hormones are kicking in. So we need to know kind of, well, how do you get from meanness to outright bullying? You say it's targeted on one person. Well, we need specific examples.
Okay. So there are different kinds of bullying. And sometimes it's the physical bullying about actually hitting or shoving somebody. But there are other ways, too. Sometimes it's the verbal bullying. So this is when they call somebody names, and especially if they get a group of kids picking on someone, that can be really awful. Mm. We also have relational aggression, which means you organize everybody to exclude someone, and that can be very vicious. And nowadays, we also have the cyberbullying, which is when you use online communication or text.
But all of those things are also mean.
They are absolutely mean. And again, we have to come back to that. Is there a power difference? So, for instance, a kid might be really upset at recess when they're all playing kickball and people say, "You're out." "Yes, you are." So, but that's not bullying, even though it's upsetting, because there isn't a power difference. It isn't targeting someone over a period of time. And we parents have to be very careful about calling these minor disagreements bullying, because it gives kids the message, "You're fragile, you can't handle it when anyone is even slightly unkind to you."
If someone is, and we've had shows about this, this learned behavior of bigotry, hate, and hate, that, to me, would be in that category of bullying, because it is beyond just being mean or picking at each other.
Exactly.
It's really, really vicious, because you are not like me, and I hate you because you're not.
I think you hit it right on the head, Terry. There's a level of viciousness, not just insensitive and, you know, brothers and sisters aren't always nice to each other. We adults haven't managed perfect marriages or world peace. So, yes,
right,
there are going to be conflicts, but the bullying takes it to a different level. So what do we do if we really, as parents, think that our kid is being bullied? I think the first question is safety. So what I often tell kids is to stand near an adult. You don't necessarily have to run and tell the adult.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly don't want to announce the bullet to the bully, "I'm telling," because that's going to make things worse. So stand near an adult or stand near some friends, and you are less of a target. We know that kids who have a friend who likes them back are less likely to be bullied. So that helping our children to make friends, to have a sense of belonging, mm-hmm, is really important. And then we need to talk, we as adults need to step in if it's a case of true bullying, if there is that power difference that makes it impossible for the child to stand up for themselves, then we need to step in and get the school administration involved in watching things and maybe stepping in to make the person make amends.
On that note, Dr. Kennedy Moore, I interview a lot of administrators, professors, and even recently I interviewed a university president. And they are sick to death of this snowflake feeling that kids come into universities with. And I think, to your point about how far should parents go, sometimes I think parents have gone way overboard.
I would agree that.
And you know, sometimes you're just going to get punched in the nose by somebody after school, and you got to learn to maybe punch back. But it's like we're trying to protect our kids all day long, and sometimes they have to just figure it out on their own. Otherwise, they're going to enter universities being snowflakes.
I recently had two separate cases where kids had a conflict, and the parents got a lawyer involved. And let me tell you, that did not help the situation.
We see that with sports teams all the time.
Right, yeah. You can't legislate kindness. Now, the other thing that's really important is having each child learn to look at their own behavior. So when kids read the, those stamp out bullying slogans, what they think is those mean kids should stop that, and they don't look at their own behavior. So I think that that's really important as parents, to help our kids learn to do the right thing, to do the kind thing. To say to your kid, you don't have to like that kid, but you may not be cruel to them.
Okay, let's move from bullies and meanness and all of that category having to do with power and safety to just making new school friends. A lot of kids are shy, especially when they're younger and they haven't been through kindergarten, K and 1 and 2, or they change schools. They're very, very shy. What to do about that? Speak a little bit about making new friends.
Sure. I think that's the number one worry of kids going back to school right now. Will I have a friend in my new class? And if year to year, especially if you're in a larger school district, the kids get stirred around a lot, and they might not have the buddy that they had last year. So I think it starts with being able to reach out for friends. So this means greeting people. And if you have a shy child, you may want to practice this. So you look the person in the eye, and if they're uncomfortable with that, they can look them in the forehead, right between the eyebrows, and nobody can tell the difference. So you look at them, you smile to show you're happy to see them, you say hi, and you say the person's name, because that makes the greeting more personal if you know their name.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's also, one of the things that we talk about in growing friendship is the magnet myth of friendship. So sometimes kids feel like they have to be so amazing and wonderful that they draw friends to them the way a magnet attracts steel. This is a myth, because that's not how friendship works. Friendship is based on that common ground, and it's a relationship between peers. So you don't have to impress everybody. You just need to get to know them and find what you enjoy doing together.
Well, those are good tips. When I was growing up, I grew up on Air Force bases. Every 3 to 4 years, my father would be stationed to a new Air Force base.
Now, bet you became an expert on making friends.
I became extroverted, too. But part of that was I come from a big family. I had 6 brothers and sisters. So I knew how to reach out, and I was pretty extroverted anyway. But I've often thought over the years, what if I was an only child and we moved? Now I just make my friends, and then 3 years I've got a, you know, K through kindergarten, first grade, and second grade, and then third, fourth, fifth, and on it goes. Now I've got to reach out again. That's harder for an only child, I think.
There is something to be said for the practice of a
the
big
practice.
Family.
That's why that's well. I loved your tips. You know, look them in the eye. If that's too frightening, look them in the mind's eye, right there on the forehead. Right. We need to leave it there, Dr. Eileen Kennedy Moore. She is the author of Growing Friendships, A Kid's Guide to Making and Keeping Friends. Good tips. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Terry.
You bet. All right, straight ahead, monkey see, monkey do. Monkeys taking selfies.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
Before I bring in Megan the Millennial and talk about monkey see, monkey do, and PETA, oh, she's going to love this one. What'd you think, John?
Well,
the interview.
Yeah, I understand. A couple of real quick thoughts. One is that it seems like there's nothing new under the sun. And this seemed very familiar to me about when I was growing up and then when I was raising my family, et cetera, et cetera. So that there's that part. With the exception of the internet and social media and that type of thing. So that adds a new dimension to it. I would hate to be a parent these days raising a child. I mean, how do you cope with that? So it's obviously the core values are the same, and you want to teach the same skills, but how do you get around something that subtle? So
good point. I mean, the internet is huge. It's here to stay, and I wasn't raised with the internet.
And the question is begged, why are we even talking about this? What is the point? Why is it important? Why are books being written? Why are experts delving into this? And the thought that comes to my mind on the micro level are issues like Sandy Hook and Columbine. That's what we care about at the micro level. At the macro level, when it comes to nation states, like you said before, there's nothing new under the sun. Nations bully each other. They make alliances with bigger, badder nations so that they can basically be defended when time comes to
we
to
call
war,
it diplomacy, but yes, it's always
indeed.
So that I am
we call it NATO
better than you and call it NATO. Good points all. Megan, monkey see, monkey do, monkey takes a selfie, and monkey owns the right to the image. You're a lawyer? Really? If the monkey takes his own selfie, does it own the right to the image? PETA says yes. And by that logic, then would that apply to a dog? Would that apply to any other animal? I know it's absurd, but judges are looking into this. PETA wants opinions. They are going to a higher court once they lost in a lower court. How crazy thinking is this?
It's so ridiculous that it's hard to see through it to get to a logical legal analysis on it, to be honest with you. You look at it and you go, I'm not sure. I mean, and quite honestly, is this the biggest thing PETA's worrying about right now? This is how they're going to validate and protect, you know, animals being treated ethically when mm-hmm. they're being hunted and poached and experimented on. But however, with that being said, if we turn a legal eye toward the case itself, obviously they aren't going to have much standing when we look at copyright law specifically. And one of the reasons is because copyright law was specifically drafted in a way to give the author, and the author is the individual who created the work, the incentive to do so. So that's the whole point behind all intellectual property law. It is to give each of us an incentive, some ownership over what we've created. It's part of the free market. If you have incentive, you have rights that you can then either keep to yourself or you can sell to others or license to others, then you have more incentive to do so. That doesn't exist with a monkey, right? The monkey did not purposefully create any work, and he or she is not an author. Now, with that being said, though, Terry, I don't think that this is a crazy approach for PETA to take. Once I got through past the ridiculousness of it all, what this could potentially do is if we look at a monkey, and of course monkeys, you know, there was an amicus brief that was filed on behalf of an anthropologist who was saying, hey, monkeys are really closely related to humans, so therefore the monkey may very well have more rights than maybe a dog per se.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at this, if we're giving monkeys the right to ownership, and this is what PETA is trying to accomplish because they're trying to define ownership here, then maybe that would extend to ownership or additional rights for monkeys and or other animals in other areas of the law. Now, that probably is the reason why they won't prevail, because obviously judges are well aware of precedent. But it's not actually the craziest approach that PETA's ever taken to try to get more rights, more almost elevate animals to the level of human rights. Because obviously, where would we go from here? If an animal can be an author and has property rights, well, then they can have property.
Well, the connection between monkeys and people is one that they're really pushing in this case. They're not pushing, have we all noted, a fish and taking a selfie.
Right.
Or a squirrel.
Well, they don't have those
really
well,
exactly.
Either, right.
Exactly. I'm going to be fascinated to see at the higher court levels. And it's a court of appeals.
Right. I mean, you know, it's really interesting to see how the judges are going to rule. And they might not even have to get to this issue. They may decide that the PETA and the attorney doesn't actually have the right to represent the monkey and its interests. Remember, you have to have a plaintiff, and that plaintiff has to have actual rights available to them and have to have hired that attorney. Well, again, we're talking about this monkey's rights. Well, who gave PETA the right to define what the monkey's rights are? And then when you look at what they want to do with the damages, and I know this is kind of a ridiculous argument, but they're saying that they want to facilitate his interests. Well, how do they know his interests aren't just sitting around eating bananas all day long?
They don't. They don't. All right, Megan, hold on. Let's hear what our town hall guests, Terry's talkers, have to say.
Welcome
when
back
we return.
To Think
You're listening
America
to Think America, Think America Radio. We're talking about PETA. You know, they love, 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 love animals. They even love it if a monkey takes his own selfie and would go to the point by saying, therefore, that monkey owns the right to that image. Well, Megan had her say. What do you say, Ray?
That was actually, funnily enough, the entire time Megan was talking, I was shaking my head. Yes, that's what they're thinking of doing. It's not necessarily just to focus on the ridiculousness of the actual case. It's to ascribe real rights to an animal that would be enjoyed in a court of law that would be able to be represented independent of an actual zoo or independent of an owner or independent of any human. That animal would now have legal standing in a court of law, and it wouldn't just be then with monkeys, because there, for example, there's an elephant that produces art, that paints in a zoo, and that elephant demonstrating a certain amount of creativity could be said that you're an elevated species. You are an intelligent species.
And what about the horse that
any one of them? And this is just basically a means to an end, to basically say that they could never actually have any of their furs taken, they could never be utilized for any kind of actual food production, they cannot be utilized for any kind of entertainment in circuses or in fairs or what have you.
Elevate the animal to Homo sapien level.
Yeah, in law.
Yeah, absolutely. They tried with dolphins and the tuna fishing thing, and they've gone to the Ninth Circuit each time, because that's the wacko circuit, and that's why they're litigating it in those courts. The argument is that a rat is a boy, and the rat is a boy argument has its roots in postmodernism and everything else, but the idea is exactly what Ray said, and it's not only to elevate the animal, but it is to discredit the human and to remove any legitimacy from the human, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And watch out. This has got so many possibilities for humor, like live streaming of the blue whale singing, you know, all this kind of stuff. But watch out, because what they're going for is they're going for the big chicken farms and all the rest of it.
They're going to turn us into vegans before you know it.
Well, and what they're doing, and the reason they're doing that is because they can reach, it'll be the tobacco 2.0. Mm-hmm. They can reach some kind of settlement,
yeah,
and it will fund them as they continue this lunacy.
And there's always money there, aside from not only what they're going to produce, but by the politicians that fund them and support them.
Right.
They're always going to be able to raise money on these fronts, raise money on these whole national campaigns of let's defend animals, let's go ahead and, you know, go fund for a ship that's going to go and intercept Japanese whaling ships. There's always money here. This is mm-hmm. never just a feel-good issue.
Well, they also have the wind at their back is the culture that neutralizes everything's a neutral playing field. Look at the rise in the movement, the transgender movement, right? It's not just a he, she, or a she, he. You can also be androgynous, and you can change, and everybody's the same. The feminists are the same as men. Men are the same as women. Everything is the same.
So many bathrooms.
Even with the PETA folks, they don't have an order to the universe where man is higher than animals.
No.
And that spirit life is higher than man.
Biology is irrelevant.
Exactly. Everything is neutral. It's a level playing field. Mm-hmm. Everything is equal. Okay, Megan, change your life technology. What do you got on board for this show?
Well, I'm sure most of our listeners don't know this, but Yellowstone National Park has a huge supervolcano, and it's the largest active volcano in the world, and it sits on a vast subterranean chamber of molten rock and gases. So, I mean, that's very interesting. It's something to brag about until you realize that it may kill us one day. Basically, we are waiting because we're hitting at about that 600,000-year mark when this supervolcano is set to erupt. And what scientists are concerned about specifically at NASA is that it will spew out a ton of ash and toxic waste that will blot out the sun and possibly annihilate the human race. So what NASA is trying to do is they're actually trying to stop this from happening. They're trying to avoid it. And what they plan on doing is by sealing some of that heat that's underneath the chamber of molten lava, because it's 1,500 degrees Celsius. When you look at their process, it's actually kind of interesting. They're going to drill a 6-mile hole into the side of the volcano and pump high-pressure water into it, which will allow the liquid to cool, to absorb some of the heat. Then when the water comes back out, it'll be heated to over 600 degrees, slowly cooling the volcano down. Then it's pumped back out again. So they're going to circulate it through. Think of almost like a nuclear reactor and how they use the water to cool it down. They want to do the same thing for this volcano. They have to be very strategic so that they don't mess with the integrity of the volcano, which would, again, possibly annihilate all life on the planet.
Wow. And the expense on all of this. Wow.
It's Yeah, it's approximately $3.5 billion.
Well, either way, it can change your life. Technology to change your life either for the worst or for better. I appreciate it, Megan. Thanks so much. Always love having Megan on the program. She's our libertarian attorney and a mom. All right, that's it for this edition of Think America. Thank you, John. Thank you, Ray. And remember, you can always find our programs, thinkamericaradio.com. Remember, reason first.
And then converse.
I'm Terry Gilbert. See you next time.